from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up next on this morning's forum program, taking care of elderly parents or other loved ones can be a challenging, emotional, and a complicated task. We'll discuss practical and emotional issues of caretaking and the rewards. That's next, after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to another hour of this morning's forum program. Every day, some 45 million baby boomers are caring for elderly parents, spouses, or friends. What should you know about caretaking? What might you expect if you fall into the role of having to be a caretaker? And what resources are available to you? And how can you best access them? I'm going to take up those questions and more in this hour. And joining us here in studio is Stefania Schaefer. She's the author of a book called Nine Realities of Caring for an Elderly Parent, A Love Story of a Different Kind. Good morning. Welcome.
Good morning, Michael. Thank you for having me here.
Glad to have you, and also glad to have Donna Shemp, who's here with us in studio as well, Director of Programs and Services Emeritus with the Family Caregiver Alliance. Welcome to the program.
Hi.
Good to have you. Ann Hinton also is here with us, and she's Executive Director of the San Francisco Department of Aging and Adult Services. Welcome, Ann Hinton.
Thank you.
Thank you all for being here. Stefania, your book is described as an indispensable guide, and it's really a mother-daughter story. It's like you say, a love story of another kind, as the subtitle points out. What you come away with are many things from reading your book, in addition to the personal story, which is very compelling. It's how difficult this is, how challenging, and in many ways, you know, there are privileges in caring for a loved one, and there are things that bring about joy, but often a thankless task.
Often a thankless job. I felt very much in it alone when I got the surprise call. I was not expecting to go home for a visit. And when I arrived on the doorstep, there was a stranger greeting me in the way of my disheveled mother, who looked like she had aged 20 years practically overnight. And as I was taking a tour of my childhood home, it was unrecognizable to me. And the screaming thought of what we were going to do about Mom when she could no longer care for herself was hitting me in the face with a 2x4. There was no escaping it now.
There had been, I mean, we don't want to necessarily get into details of this, but your case was very particular in that there was estrangement. You had not had contact with your mother for 9 years and wound up living with her for 5 years.
That's right. I was the best call she could have made. And when I came home, I left all the baggage at the front step, because I think compassion takes over when you are actually looking at someone who is a cry for help. There is nothing more important than realizing there's always been a bond of love. And, you know, the trajectory of family dynamics and mother-daughter relationships, there's that ebb and flow at times. And this was my time where I was going to fulfill her wish that she remain in her own home for the rest of her life.
Well, you and those like you are kind of unsung heroes as far as I'm concerned. But everybody should go in this with their eyes open. And the book really helps to bring that into focus, because it's scary, it's hard, it's stressful. You use those words. But you also talk about, well, the humor, the gift of the joy, and the privilege of doing what you did.
Privilege, for sure, to know that you enabled another human being to live the rest of their life with dignity, as they would have cared for themselves if they could. That was a tremendous honor. At the end, I realized, being alone with her when she died in my arms, that, you know, I got to witness her life. I got to hear her last words to me, which were, "Thank you. You're wonderful." And that will stay with me forever. And I have no regrets.
You also got to do something that your father wanted done. I mean, this was dutiful in a way, wasn't it?
I knew that my father would have wanted to know that his beloved wife of 54 years was not going to have to go it alone at the end. And there is something about that. You know, I'm an educator. Teaching is mobile in the sense that I was able to relocate, get a job in a new district. But I had no idea what I said yes to. And you alluded to that a moment ago, Michael. Firefighters, nurses go into the profession asking a few questions up front about what a typical day on the job is like. This book will answer your question if you are the adult child going home to care for your elderly parent till the very end. You've arrived. Your next question is, now what? This book will answer that for you.
Of course, what the book also points out is you don't always know when the very end is going to be.
You do not.
And sometimes that becomes part of the exasperation and frustration at the same time that you're caring for this and loving this person.
The anxiety that goes into it, because when you are preparing for birth, you know you have 9 months. In death, there is no timeline. So when a decline begins, and when I arrived, I want to remind listeners, she was healthy and buoyant and alert, but could not manage her home. She was 85 years old, and the chores and the bills and the cats and the mail were just coming up on her.
It was a mess. We had Roz Chess on, who wrote about caring for her parents in a cartoon version of that, and she talked about the grime, you know, and you talk about the cat urine and the rat droppings. And I mean, some
and the
of
the ants everywhere.
Pismires everywhere. I mean, there's all that, and then there's all the professional and networking help you need, which a lot of people just can't afford. And that gets us into talking with some of our other guests here in terms of the kind of services and resources that are out there. But there's also the grief that comes afterward.
There's the grief, and now my father had passed away 13 years prior to me coming back on the scene. And after losing my mother, there's that disorienting phrase you feel when you hear the term adult orphan, and you are living that. And I think as we baby boomers are aging, there's going to be an epidemic where we're all feeling this complete void and loneliness and not really realizing how to care for ourselves and get through that.
You did find a husband out of this, though.
I mean, luckily did.
There was some joy and luck that was involved. This is a roofer. And he was,
Well, you know how it went, Michael, is there were 85 boxes in the garage of paperwork, financial paperwork, and I was trying to connect all the dots, and I realized the home insurance policy had been forcefully terminated a couple of years earlier, and the only way to reinstate it was with a roof inspection, which I found to be ridiculous, but I went along with it. And who should show up but the handsome roofer? And eventually, you know, we fell in love, and my mother called him her son-in-love, and I've never heard her use a term like that before. And he brought out the best in her, and I'm so glad he joined the family before her decline.
Well, the biggest advice, I think, that I came away with from your book, and certainly it was advice that I had to go through my own experience realizing, is the importance of a will and a durable power of attorney and all of that. I mean, just in terms of finances and in terms of setting things up. And
the starter kit of four. You need the power of attorney for health, the power of attorney for finances, a will, and a separate trust.
Donna Shemp, the big problem that comes out of this book and of so much of caretaking is not only the isolation for the person who's being taken care of, but the isolation for the caregiver.
Right. And Stefania actually is a poster child for probably my soapbox, which is that caregivers don't self-identify. So they don't go around saying, I'm a caregiver. It's I'm a daughter, I'm a husband, I'm a wife, I'm a son. And so they don't know the services out there. So Stefania did this without the support that's available, and particularly here in the Bay Area. And Anne will talk a little bit about that also. But Family Caregiver Alliance, our job is to help the caregiver take care of themselves and to empower them as caregivers to know about the resources that would like give her a respite break, would have given her a chance to get out of there, would have given her a free consultation with an attorney. That would have helped put all those things together.
And also to answer questions like when to go into a conservatorship or when to put mom or dad in a home and all those. Yeah.
And also someone that would have been on the other end of a telephone whenever she needed help. And also support groups and other things that, you know, maybe mom would have done well in an adult daycare center. There's all kinds of things. But if you're making it up as you go along and you don't know that there are other people out there so that you don't, you do feel isolated, And people get lonelier and lonelier the longer that they're caregivers.
I desperately could have used a weekend away, and it was very difficult because she took diabetes insulin shots, right. And nobody wanted to assume that liability. And I did try those adult daycare centers, but then she couldn't remember what class she was supposed to go to and would sit in the lobby for 2 hours.
Oh, no, but adult daycare is not –
that's not a senior center.
No. Oh. Adult daycare is for people who are disabled, and they go into a place where there is everybody. There. It's not self-directed.
Okay, I understand. You
see, again, there's so many resources.
So much I don't know still.
Right, yeah.
But Stefania learned a lot about the necessity of just caring constantly. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's like a full-time job. You know, they got
second
appointments to go to.
Job.
They have to take medications. They
That's
have
right.
exercise that they have to do. And a lot of the neuro disorders, don't you, Donna Shemp, recommend, which sounds counterintuitive on the face of it, that a lot of these neuro disorders ought to prompt the caregiver to go along with the illusion when
yeah.
Yeah,
yeah.
Talk about
there's
that.
There's a whole skill set in dealing with dementia. And the skill set in dealing with dementia is counterintuitive. So our natural instinct when someone says something like,
totally out to lunch.
Totally out to lunch. Yeah. Like, you're my mother, okay? And we'll say, no, Mom, I'm your daughter.
Mm-hmm.
Rather than say, tell me about your mother. So rather than contradict her and try to orient her to reality, which is what we would naturally do, mm-hmm. the skill set in dealing with dementia is to learn how to go with the flow, and distract her or find out what she's really thinking about,
Mm-hmm.
But it's the thing is that if caregivers don't get support and they don't go to a dementia support group or learn about Alzheimer's or other dementias. You're making it up as you go along. You're going to make mistakes, and it's going to get frustrating. It makes your job that much harder.
It's a high bar, too.
It's a very high bar.
In terms of learning all those things. Yeah.
And caregivers get burnt out. They have higher incidence of depression, and they actually get more illnesses because of the fact that you're so stressed out.
I read all that, and I know it was very stressful. We had a lot of fun, too. And for me, I don't think the onset dementia was as obvious until hospice came on the scene, because there were a lot of episodes where I think, that's odd behavior, and rationalize it away over a couple of years. Mm-hmm. If everything had occurred in 2 weeks, I would say to the doctor, here's the 15 things that just happened, and he would have had a clearer picture. But episode to episode, you think, oh, that's just Mom being unusual today.
Yeah, we'll get past this one and on the next one. Ann Hinton, let's talk about resources here and what's available and what people can get access to.
Well, Donna's correct. There's really a lot available. But again, if you don't know that it's there, then you move along the same path that you and many caregivers are on. I mean, it's really then you have to hunt yourself for things. And that's hard.
Mm-hmm.
It might be easier in a community where maybe there's one or two things and everybody knows, but this is San Francisco, and we have a number of services that are available. So anything from home care, especially there's a public home care for people who are low income, to daycare, which Donna mentioned, just some counseling to have someone on our staff, for example, hear what's going on and then try to help problem solve and think about all the resources that are available in the community. I think sometimes caregivers, like you knew you wanted a weekend away and mm-hmm. you needed someone who could mm-hmm. work with your mom who had diabetes. But some people don't know what they mm-hmm. want. They simply know that they're very frustrated, they're mm-hmm. very burned out, mm-hmm. and they're very tired.
Mm-hmm.
And they're so concerned about their loved one. So they're not just going to leave them with anybody,
right.
But there's all those things. So we have staff, and certainly other organizations in our community have staff that can help puzzle through those things.
But you have so many people who are in this sandwich generation, or mm-hmm. they're caring for their parents, and they're also caring for their children. And, it's, I know to a lot of people, frankly, maddening.
Right. Well, and you can have the long-distance caregiving. You can have I'm-just-around-the-corner caregiving. It could be a very close friend that's doing it and has really committed to this person in a way, or it could be, family. So
you need a whole network, really, don't you?
You do need a whole network.
It takes a community to be a caregiver.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
It does.
And yet, just on a day-to-day level, when you read Stefania's book, you realize, about things like cooking and leaving on the stove and
yes.
tripping and, you know, all of those hazards,
right.
sharp corners on tables. I mean,
right.
like you look for children, really,
right.
or toddlers.
You have to senior-proof your home for safety.
Exactly. And then you think, I mean, I remember when my dad shouldn't have been driving, and my sister said, well, mm-hmm. you know, what are you going to do, take away his driving privileges? You know, his ego, his pride, he thinks he's a good driver. He was going into dementia. You shouldn't
yeah.
be out on the road. You
there
know,
no
you
choice.
Have all those kind of
yeah.
terrible moral quandaries.
Well, and you know, I always say to people, you know, we feel so guilty about those kinds of decisions, like taking the keys away or even putting someone in a mm-hmm. in a care facility, and you know, we confuse having to do something very hard with being wrong, and you know, it's not wrong, but it is very, very hard. Mm-hmm. You know, we confuse also guilt with regret. Guilt means we did something wrong. Regret is I had to make a terrible, horrible, no good, very bad decision. And I had to do it.
And there are multiple layers to the decision making. Mm-hmm. I knew my mother's wish was to remain in her home. So I knew unless something came in beyond my ability, I would be there to fulfill that wish. And I wanted to bring out the point, too, that what do you do? You're inheriting a decades-old home that's filled with clutter and paperwork and finances. That would be very difficult to hire a clean sweep crew because I found assets and wealth hidden in the garage in 85 boxes that somebody else wouldn't have recognized what it was. And then there would have been that.
And there's also, just thinking about older caregivers. I mean, we're talking because of the numbers about baby boomers here.
Right.
But, you know, when my mother started faltering, my father was picking her up and
right.
putting her in a bathtub, picking her up, and he was frail and
right.
he was enfeebled, you know.
Right.
I mean, the problems are legion. And just knowing that some of those resources are out there and knowing that you can avail yourself of them becomes – you wouldn't do it again, though, would you, Stephanie?
You know what? I don't know if I have the energy knowing what I know now. I don't know – if I have that kind of energy to expend. And the hardest part is I didn't know how long it would last. There was longevity. I signed up for what I thought would be a 10-year commitment. You know, it surprised me that it was only 5 years. But if it was 9 months, then you have some scope and you can handle your day-to-day. But mm-hmm. the monstrous tasks, like you mentioned earlier, Michael, the running to doctor's appointments back and forth, and that's for a healthy senior. When you have specialists involved, you're on rotations every week, it seems.
I think I'm taking a quote right out of your book, act with urgency in all you do.
That's
right. I mean,
right.
the necessity of acting with urgency. Let me open the phone lines now, and listeners, you may want to talk about your own experiences here, but also you may want to ask about suggestions, what caregivers should be thinking about in the early stages, what sorts of things should you be sure to take care of, what doesn't need to be done, as well as what needs to be done. And let me give you the phone number. It's toll-free, and you can join us now. 866-733-6786 is the number for your phone calls. Again, toll-free, 866-733-6786. You can also email us. Email address is forum@kqed.org, or go to our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on the segment. And you know, we've got a lot of people three people with a lot of experience here who can really help and make a very difficult and certainly challenging task at least less onerous. There are other ways to join us. You can go to our Facebook page or you can tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQEDForum. And maybe talk about, just for a little bit here, before we go to callers and listeners and bring them into this, ways to get through this. I mean, certainly you want to emphasize the love, the compassion, the joyful parts of this, the privilege that you spoke of and so forth, but are there really any kind of tricks to just getting through it on a day-to-day basis? Because this is what we're talking about.
I'll just say for us, we loved finding the funny in as many days as we could. We had a couple of really great years, and she would love the Ellen DeGeneres stand-up video Here and Now, and Ellen does a routine where she walks into a plate glass window and she's bleeding and she's like, my eye, can anybody help me find my eye? And my mom would do that routine spontaneously. And when my husband came on board, there
used to be... It doesn't sound very funny.
Oh, my husband would go to the gag store and get plastic eyeballs and roll them on the floor whenever my mom would hold her little doll hand over her face. say, can somebody help me find my eye? Things like that are priceless.
Yeah, actually, my dad would love sitting watching old James Bond movies. Mm-hmm. I mean, you got to find what it is that's entertaining. Mm-hmm. And you know, like with a child in some ways, if you right. put them in front of Sesame Street or something.
Right.
The other thing I think is really essential is for caregivers to understand that they're important also. Mm-hmm. You know, you're in a constantly giving role, so you're going to end up depleted. Mm-hmm. But caregivers have to understand that they have to take care of themselves as well as the person they're caring for. And often the caregiver as a person gets lost in the caregiving. And so that caregiver self-care, I think, is really essential.
We spoke earlier, too, about how thankless caregiving is. And I remember First Lady Rosalind Carter wrote a book about caregiving mm-hmm. years ago, had her on the program, and she said one of the most important things are those who are, you know, the loved ones of the caretaker and the friends of the caretaker, to give them not only support, like we're talking about, but also give them strokes, you know, let them know yes. that they mm-hmm. admire the yes. what you're doing, because mm-hmm. it is selfless mm-hmm. so often.
And I think for family members that are at a distance, that's one of the most one of the best gifts they can give. But they also, because I was my brother was and sister were close to where my dad lived, but I was out here. So, you know, helping with bills or helping with whatever you can help with, even when you're not the person that's right on site, is really, really important.
So talk about
the
that.
Thanking people
that,
is.
Excuse me, that problem, too, of geography with siblings. I mean, it's a big one.
Well, it is. And it's so easy to miscommunicate or misunderstand communications or to feel like you're doing it alone and where's everyone else. And the truth is everybody's circumstances are different. But all of us can contribute in some way. So I was thinking about this on the way in today mm-hmm. that, you know, for some people it's, you know, to your brother, do you need new tires on the car, you know, maybe that's something I could help with because you're driving mom all over the place and mm-hmm. taking care of all these things. Mm-hmm. Or would cab vouchers work for you? I mean, is that another way for mm-hmm. to help you out in some way?
That is an ideal, thoughtful scenario mm-hmm. for families. Yeah. And yet I come to it with a perspective of maybe some fractured family dynamics and my siblings were limited in the yeah. support that they could offer. Yeah.
And most families, I would say, have fractured family relationships.
Yes. Right.
The division of labor is unequal in
right.
so many families.
Absolutely.
And so is the division of finances and right. financial support.
Yes.
But let me bring one of our callers in. Let's begin, Simon, with you. Good morning. You're on the air.
Hi. I think it could actually be very unhealthy and dysfunctional for people to take care of relatives like that, both for the caregiver and the person being taken care of. If they don't understand the very specific fine details of the situation, specifically, I just want to say we don't have social workers with master's degrees for no reason. I've seen really bad things occur because people that didn't know what they were doing took care of someone or tried to and caused problems for themselves and for the person they're taking care of.
Well, what about Simon's argument? You need a professional for this kind of work, which is really work that we're talking about, Stefania? Or?
I feel very much that it was daunting, it was hard, but I was in regular contact with primary care physicians, and I felt like that was my first go-to. CPA was also on my team. Estate attorney was also on my team. My mother, you know, you have to remember, was very buoyant and alert for many of my years there, but was falling sporadically. And when that can turn into a broken hip, that was my greatest worry. The whole onset dementia came when hospice team was on site.
Madonna, Ren.
Also, well, Family Caregiver Alliance, which serves the whole Bay Area, you know, our job is to support the caregivers. Mm-hmm. And so we are master's level social workers and gerontologists. And you know, our job is to help the caregivers walk through what they're doing and give them both, again, resources, advice, support. Yeah, and you do need that. Doing it by yourself and on your own and making it up is just the worst way to do it.
Donna, that would have been so invaluable to me. I wished I'd have known about you then.
Okay, we'll hear from some more listeners from your experiences as well. And we're talking about caring for aging parents, but also really being a caretaker, what it means to be a caretaker for someone who has become, at whatever stage of life, more helpless. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're talking about caring for aging parents, really caretaking in general, and taking care of elderly parents can obviously be a challenging and emotional and complicated task. We're talking about ways to handle the practical and emotional issues around caring for parents as they age or caretaking in general. Stefania Schaefer is with us in studio. She's the author of 9 Realities of Caring for an Elderly Parent, A Love Story of a Different Kind. And Donna Shemp is here as well, Director of Programs and Services Emeritus with the Family Caregiver Alliance. And Ann Hinton, who is Executive Director of the San Francisco Department of Aging and Adult Services. And we are going to go to more of your calls and emails. You can join us at our toll-free number. It's 866-733-6786. Our email address is forum@kqed.org. And you can go to our website as well, which is kqed.org/forum, and click on the segment or tweet us, our Twitter handle, @KQEDForum. And just talking, that first call from Simon prompted a good deal of thought and discussion among all four of us here. The idea, I suppose, you know, you can hear from, say, pediatricians who will say, I don't want to treat my own kids because, you know, too many personal feelings involved, or gynecologists, I don't want to treat my own wife, whatever, you know, go through the list of those. But when you're caring for a parent, for example, sometimes the whole roles and the kind of thought process that goes into having been a child and caring for this parent who is, in many instances, enfeebled and helpless, you know, you can talk to them in a way that doesn't necessarily in any way approximate the way you should be talking to them or listening to them and hearing them. And
the role reversal
that
can happen a lot. You're used to a parent, we're just talking about this, who makes the decisions, right, and gives you direction even when you're 45. And now you're having to not just suggest, but you're having to make decisions yourself. And there's, I think, a lot of tension and stress that comes with that. The instance you gave earlier about the driver's license, somebody who can't drive, and now you're the adult child saying, you know, Dad, you know, can't do this anymore. It creates a very, very, I think, stressful situation. One of the things I was thinking about earlier, and that is one of the most wonderful things that those of us that are 65 and over can do for our families is to tell them, you know, before things happen, what it is we want. And, mm-hmm. and something more than, I don't want to go to an institution. Something that talks about what our values are. A conversation about, what do you want me to do if you can't drive anymore? What are the things that you value the most that you want me to know about you? Because I don't know that as children we always do. And then just to say back to Simon's call that we get a lot of calls in Adult Protective Services, in our Protective Services Division, from people who are reporting situations that absolutely involve caregivers who are, again, very frustrated, don't really know what to do, don't have any support, don't have the team that you've been talking about.
And alas, we see the problem of adult abuse surfacing
That's
its
right.
ugly head in these kinds of situations.
That's right.
Yeah. Well, let's go to more of your calls. Let's go to Amanda next. Amanda, you're on. Hi.
Hi. I just found myself as a daughter-in-law thrust into full-time caregiving.
Well, you must have felt I didn't sign up for this, huh?
Right. I mean, I had come back for we live out of state, and I'd come back to California for a 4-month sabbatical to work on a writing project. And literally 3 days after I arrived, I was doing 24/7 for care for my father-in-law, who previously I had seen maybe once a year. Even when we lived in California, my partner was not close to him. Yet we saw him on his birthday. You know, there had been a marriage and divorce, and he'd kind of picked the ex-wife, you know. But here I was. I was the only one who wasn't working full-time who was here, and all of a sudden I'm caring for this person. And I wanted to say two things in particular. Also that apparently when I started doing, you know, research and finding care, I heard a lot, you know, more and more daughters-in-law are doing this, which I thought was interesting. The other thing is, I was the kind of parent that, you know, I would take a difficult 13-year-old over a crying baby any day of the week. And I think what was so hard for me, taking care of an elderly person who has, he just doesn't have dementia, but there's some cognitive deficit and, you know, a great deal of physical weakness, is you are looking at that open-ended timeline in which somebody is going to be regressing the whole time instead of progressing. And it just, my partner and I kept on saying to each other, I'm so tired. I'm so tired. Why am I so tired? All I do is sit around all day and maybe cook a meal and drive to a doctor's appointment. Why am I so tired? And the last thing is that my father-in-law, after about 6 weeks of this, he said to me, you know, Nancy and I never discussed what we wanted to do. We never talked about what to do, if, when. And there were a lot of choices that they made that if I just think it's crucial that if you have aging parents, you need to have, you know, a very complete talk with them now, because they could have, for example, afforded long-term care insurance, but, oh, that's too expensive. They were giving that much money away to charity every month.
I also don't like to talk about those subjects, Amanda. You know, they're verboten, and that's a need that we have of a cultural shift of sort. I'm looking at a website comment from a listener named Maureen who said, four words, long-term care insurance, an absolute lifesaver and a gift for all involved. But this crucial talk, Stefania, I mean, it can't be emphasized enough.
You bring up a couple good points there that I want to address. And one is, statistically speaking, the job of caring for an elderly parent falls to a female relative 46 years or older. And it is not just the daughter or the niece or granddaughters. It can be daughters-in-law. And that is just where our culture is in our society. You know, sons are more comfortable writing checks when it comes to taking personal care, bathing, diapering, perhaps an elderly mother. That's not where we're at. And secondly, the regression, you're right. It's not going to be a disease that progressively improves. You will see in stages the regression. It goes from confusion to regression. I was so grateful that my mother was grateful that I was there and could express appreciation and love. I heard so many stories from hospice nurses about relatives who are angry at their children caregivers and throw things at them. And that would have made it compounded difficult work. And you think you're tired when you're, you know, preparing those meals and running those errands. When you are watching your parent wrestle against death, everything leading up to it, as if it wasn't hard enough. This is where the gut-wrenching job begins. And when the death happens, the business of death will keep you prevented from going through grief and taking care of yourself and licking your wounds. It never ends.
Yeah, Stefania Schaefer is the author of Nine Realities of Caring for an Elderly Parent, a love story of a different kind, apropos of that descent. Chris writes, my mother had Alzheimer's for 10 years and ended up living with my brother, God bless him, but the biggest revelation was the slow onset of the disease. Please let people know that when your parent starts making lists, it's helping them to remember, and they are afraid, and this makes them feel organized and safe. If they can't remember what you talked about the day before, it's a sign, and get help early.
Most people have dementia 3 to 5 years before diagnosis, and it's only when they look back they say, oh, that's what was happening.
Hindsight's our best teacher.
Right. But I also want to address the other issue from Amanda, which is that it's important to play, I call it the what if game with parents. Mm-hmm. So, you know, or loved ones, whoever it may be. So what if you got hit by a bus? What if, you know, and
don't be silly. I don't want to talk about that. I mean, that's the kind of response you get, isn't it?
Yeah. But, you know, if you can say, I won't be able to take care of you without knowing the answers to those questions for you. You know, you can, and the what if game, you can also use things like television shows, ER, or, you know, Grey's Anatomy, or any of those kinds of things, or newspaper articles as opportunities to talk about those things.
Or something that happened with a close friend, something else that you know of, or you know, and another way to get into it is really to talk about values. This is what I think is valuable to you, but I really need to know what would be important to you.
Glenn, can you talk a little bit more about recognizing dementia? That is, what to look for when you need to get more help for an aging person?
Yeah, and I was just thinking with the caller, you know, the fastest growing age group is the 85 plus, at least in our community, and one out of every two 85-year-olds has dementia, which is a pretty staggering statistic. And it's something that as a community and as family members, we really need to think about. Now, you don't want to jump, you know, the first time somebody mislays their keys or whatever it might be to thinking.
I would have jumped just yesterday. Yeah.
That's right. But on the other hand, when you start seeing continual signs of things that are different than what you have previously seen, you know, it's really time, I think, to get that cognitive checkup. And the wonderful thing about being in San Francisco is we have a number of organizations that can do that for you. It's not every primary care physician that is really set up to do that. They could. It's a pretty simple step and a pretty simple test to begin that process. But that's really not how physicians operate primarily in our community. But there are places you see and other places that people can go to get a clear definition and a clear diagnosis of what's going on. And then it helps you as a family plan, but it also helps you figure out how do you make the house work, right? What are the things you need to change? What are the things you need to leave as they are? Where are those danger points? We were talking about that earlier, right?
The
rugs that slip, mm-hmm. the furniture. And at the same time, you want to do those things early because as dementia progresses, people are really relying on what kind of the rote of things. So you don't want to be changing the furniture around at a point when mm-hmm. someone has learned that path mm-hmm. through their house. They know how to find the bathroom. Mm-hmm. So doing things earlier than later is really, really important.
Another kind of follow-up question in terms of doing things that are important. Bill asks, is there a single source, whether in print or online, that evaluates licensed assisted living facilities, nursing homes, convalescent hospitals in California in the matter of consumer reports?
So every community has an ombudsman program, and ombudsmans are great organizations for people to go to. Also, there's the California licensing. So you can go to their website. The state of California has a licensing bureau, and they keep tabs of who's doing what. Now, we've had some bad situations, especially in our community, of assisted living where there was one just in East Bay not too long ago where the
Castro
owners
Valley.
Walked out
Castro Valley,
and
yeah.
left the cook and the maintenance man to care for 16 people. Yeah. So we are beefing, you know, we're seeing the state beef up in that area. And then Canner. Canner is just, I think, a godsend to all of us because they really do keep up on local facilities and what was the last evaluation report and do they have cases of abuse in their file or whatever they might be. So Canner and the Ombudsman and, of course, the State of California licensing would be the places to check.
And once again, Ann Hinton is Executive Director of the San Francisco Department of Aging and Adult Services. Stefania Schaefer is author of 9 Realities of Caring for an Elderly Parent. And Stefania, Mike wants to know, how does one deal with the irritations and annoyance that often build up when one has to take care of a loved one 24/7 for many months, or in your case, 5 years?
I am a 7th grade teacher, so I've had that
good training
for many years, and I'm very measured, and I just kept thinking how much this would mean to my father. And my mother was like a baby. She regressed. And in the times when she would hallucinate and I was a witness to her life, she would go back and talk about the connections that she had with other relationships, friends. And it was so illuminating. I could not begrudge her anything, diapering her messes. It was hard, but you know, I was so grateful that I could be there because I could be tender with her and I could appreciate this as our last walk in life.
You build a new bond, really. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's what my sister said was really the great gift.
But you also, back to the frustration issue, yeah. One, you need skills and you need skill training, whether that's mechanical in terms of how to transfer somebody, how to change mm-hmm. a diaper, how to give them a bath, as well as how to deal with their personalities and their behaviors. And you need someone to talk to. You need a place to piss and moan, you know? I mean, we all need to be able to, you know, let that out somewhere.
Well, actually, I think you may have answered a tweet, but you might want to elaborate a little bit from Elizabeth, who says, how can friends and family of a caregiver help, particularly someone who loses sight of self-care? How do you decide which sibling does what as caregivers? Boy, there's a question that's of monumental Solomonic wisdom necessary.
I think I – oh, go ahead, Anne.
I was going to say sometimes it's a matter of where everyone's located. I mean, it would have been natural in our family for myself to have been responsible for health care. But I was in California and my dad was in South Dakota. So my brother was there. He ended up becoming the person for health care because my dad needed somebody really on site, and I did the finances because I could do those long distance. So sometimes it's just the practical. It's not always what we're the best at. I mean, I have to say, you wish it would be that, but it's not always. And the other thing I think that family and friends can do, even when the caregiver isn't going to go out and isn't going to let you leave, is you can visit. right? You can come over and you can bring the coffee cake and you can make a pot of coffee and the three of you can sit around and have a conversation. And maybe as the caregiver sees you and your mother interact, maybe there will come a day when she will say, you know, I'd like to run to the store. Could you stay with mom for a little bit? It's not always pushing our own opinion of what should happen, because when you're a caregiver, you're caught up in all of that. But how do you be a friend to somebody and really think that through, but also being a friend to the person who needs the care?
I think a lot of my friends felt like I fell off the grid during this time caring for my mom, and they did not realize the magnitude and the scope of what I was involved with.
Right.
And it wasn't until after reading this book or talking to me personally that they realized, why didn't you reach out? And I would say I was so beyond inundated. Mm-hmm. I couldn't pick up the phone and call sometimes. Mm-hmm. There were people who could have brought over dinner. That would have been wonderful. So one less thing for me to think about. Mm-hmm. We had touched earlier on what can people who are in this situation begin to do to prepare today. And we talked about safe-proofing the home. I want to make sure that adult children are aware of medications parents are taking, dosages, prescriptions, because when you go to the emergency room and you're not expecting that trip, that's the first thing nurses are going to want to know. I didn't know. And their recommendation was have a chart. So I created one. It's in the book. It's very descriptive and detailed. We talked about people may be running errands for you, dropping off groceries, but you need to understand how are meals being prepared. If you're not inside those walls, my mother was spoon-feeding herself from a jar of Ragu and calling that dinner. That's another warning sign. You have to be aware of how that person is living within that house.
I want to actually read an email from – go ahead, Donna Shen.
Oh, and I was just going to say, and the best thing a friend can do is to call and say, how are you doing? Because mm-hmm. our natural response is, how's your mom?
Yep.
So just saying, how are you? Yeah. And say, it's okay it's okay for you to call me when you're having a bad day and, you know, just complain.
Really
excellent
valid
advice.
Point.
Yeah. And I want to get to more calls here, but Leslie in Oakland brings up a whole different issue here. She says, great and timely discussion. Could you guys speak to the relative, daughter or son, for example, who just abandons his or her 90-something mother with Alzheimer's? I'm thinking of my neighbor, 94, whose daughter, who lives in Florida but grew up in the Bay Area, took her mother to her bank, had her sign a power of attorney over her accounts, and promptly helped herself to about $80,000 and went home the same day and has not been heard of since. That was 2 years ago. As a longtime neighbor, my spouse and I have stepped in to help and found an agency with excellent caregivers when her longtime companion, who was 100 at the time, could no longer handle the isolation, the difficulty of showering her, etc. Really sad and shocking, but I wonder if your guests could speak to this. It must not be that uncommon.
I don't think it is. Sad and shocking, but it is. And I think, obviously, the two sides of the story, right? I mean, you went and took care of your mom and put your life on semi-hold for 5 years. These neighbors have stepped in and to be helpful. So I think the good is still outweighs the negative things that the daughter absconded with the money. But it is true that
people do take advantage of the elderly.
Take advantage,
yeah. Which is why adult protective services exist.
Right. Right. Whether you're a friend or a family member, I mean, we see this very, very often that it's easy for people to walk in, especially with an older adult that hasn't put things in place, right, to protect themselves from those kinds of
things. Which is why if you are a caretaker, really look to those financial records,
yes.
As Stefania points out in her book, and see what's there and maybe hidden money under the mattress, whatever. Let me get some more calls on here. And Priscilla, join us. You're on the air. Hi.
Hi. Well, thank you so much for having this sort of show. I think it's really important. So my mother about 2 years ago had a traumatic brain injury, and she was left in a semi-comatose state, completely bedridden. And since then, she's made some progress, but it's been minimal, but it's been, you know, very well received by us as her children. So I think 2 points, really. I think it's really important to have those legal documents, that will, that living trust, especially if you have children, but I think even also to spread that message for athletes or other folks, like you don't have to be over a certain age to have those documents. I think that's one point that I wanted to make. I think another point, we had to find a skilled nursing facility, and it was really difficult. We had a lot of sort of guilt to have to put her in a facility like this, but I think what we've done as a family, I'm one of five, and I'm the youngest of five, and just daily monitoring to avoid like bed sores and infections, constant advocating to the nursing directors and to her primary care provider on what progress she's made or what concerns, especially around physical therapy. And then I think my main question for your panelists is, are there resources for those extreme cases when individuals are bedridden to keep them at home or to bring them home?
So I'd just like to suggest, and our office has a central information and counseling line where you can get linked, you can get some problem-solving help, you can be linked to services, and that number is 355-6700, 355-6700. So that's a place to start, because depending on your finances or your loved one's finances, someone on that phone can really help you figure out what's available to you. So hopefully that would be of help. I also wanted to say something about institutional care. You know, my dad thrived in a nursing home. He had a very, very bad dementia. I think he lived longer because he was there. He was around people. This was a very small community, so people knew him, even though he didn't know them anymore. They were in and out saying hi, Lee, and he responded to them. He had problems at sunset, you know. He was up and he was walking and he wanted to leave town or find his motorcycle or whatever. And that nurse would bring his bed out and put it in the hallway and he would stay at the nurse's station. So I think it depends on what the illness is of the person in terms of what's going to be the best place for them. For many, many, many of us, being at home is the right, absolutely the right.
The majority of people who have been polled, overwhelmingly majority, say that's what they want. Yeah. But it is kind of case by case.
It is case by case.
Here's a listener who asks, I'm 65, I don't have children, my nieces are not geographically close, and I don't want to suddenly or gradually become a burden on them. What should I be doing now to plan ahead for the time when I cannot care for myself and make sure my last days are not prolonged or handled in a crisis management way? How specific can one be in their legal documents?
Can be very specific in your legal documents, and you can also line up services before you need them. I can remember a gentleman who was he was 70, which very, very young, called an organization that I was working for, and he hired one of our private care managers, and what he wanted from her was because he had no family, and he laid out for her what he wanted, and she checked in on him on a regular basis, but she was prepared to do that. So there's a lot that a person can do to make sure that their legal documents are in order and the things that they want taken care of in terms of care can be taken care of.
And also friends, pastors,
yes.
Look at your larger community. I always say aunts, uncles, cousins, and neighbors, you know.
Yeah.
Listener writes, probably a good reminder, remind your listeners that elderly deaf are often misdiagnosed as having dementia or Alzheimer's.
It's true.
And Vicky writes, having been the caregiver for three bedridden invalids, mother, father, and aunt for 15 years, another hero, and now with the responsibility for my 76-year-old husband recently diagnosed with Alzheimer's and a 98-year-old mother-in-law, I learned one lesson that all caregivers must follow. When caregiving starts to degrade the caregiver, nobody benefits, least of all the care recipient. Caregivers, you must take time to care for yourself. Find something you look forward to doing every day, every week, every month, and do it.
Good advice.
Very sage.
Excellent.
Elaine writes, I have a real interest in developing support for seniors and pet companions. Pets often become like children or best friends to seniors, and yet because of hard realities, caring for them or keeping them and their seniors together can be problematic. Example, if mom and dad downsizes and pets aren't allowed, a senior has to face suddenly losing their best friend and a weak deadline. As we recognize the importance of animal companionship, how does this relate to the role of caretakers? I'm sure it adds yet one more responsibility on them, yet it's such an important component to a person's life.
Well, my mom was married to her three cats. Loved them, did not want to lose them, even though she knew she couldn't manage them. And I know that those cats brought a lot of joy and happiness into her life. But, you know, she couldn't really take care of them, so I'm glad I could be there to help. One point I also wanted to add to this conversation is we have not mentioned the valuable resource that AARP is, and they have a Prepare to Care booklet that for anyone not knowing how to start the conversation, how to safety-proof the home, how to download forms so that parents can say, these are my express wishes. This is where I want the blue vase to go. It's a great 5-page starter.
And again, Stefania Schaefer's book is 9 Realities of Caring for an Elderly Parent, a love story of a different kind. Here's Tony, who writes, your listeners might consider hiring professional organizers. They have experience, compassion, and knowledge to go through those boxes of paper, clear cutter, and know what to do with it once removed and help downsize seniors' homes. And another listener writes online, my mother lives with my husband and I, now that she's retired, I think the hardest part for me are her emotional breakdowns and mood swings, since she now feels that she's not in control of anything. How do you deal with this? Also, I deal with them since she's my mother, but how do I help my husband deal with them?
Well, first of all, you want to talk to the doctor and see what the doctor can do. Counseling is available if she doesn't have dementia, but sometimes it can be a result of either medications or maybe they need medications. Depression is really common. And depression is a treatable disease, and we need to look at what those possibilities are.
I think that's the other way in which a professional could be helpful, or an adult day health center might be helpful, or a case manager, because we all need to feel productive, right? No matter how old we are or how frail or how sturdy we are, we need to feel productive. So having someone else maybe brainstorm with you in ways in which your mom or your mother-in-law or whoever it is can still be participating in the world. But I am with Donna. I think first you want to make sure you get a good diagnosis and make sure that there's not some underlying something going on that could be treated.
Let me read one more online comment. A lot of stories here and some of them very touching. Charlie writes, this program reaches deep into my heart. I took care of my mother for 2 years and it was a shock. When I reached her home in North Carolina for a 10-day visit, I discovered someone I did not know. My mother was no longer there, and that was the first shock. We did share good times. I moved her to California and spent hours and days with her, laughing with her, watching baseball, going to chemo sessions, PET scans, etc. The worst part of all of it was the total disregard and unkindness of my only sister and her adult daughters, who did nothing to help, but did all they could to injure me. It's been 5 years yesterday since my mom died, and I'm still reeling from it. I miss my mom, but also my only sibling basically told me to drop dead. All I ever wanted was a simple thank you. I love my mom. We were not always close, but she was my mother, and I wouldn't be with her. I would be with her to the end of her life. I just want to bring that in because these stories of sibling enmity and of, mother not being the mother, it reminds me of Proust, who looked at his mother and said, this wasn't my mother as she got older. This is not the mother I grew up with and took care of me. It's a different person.
Michael, I want to speak to Charlie's comment when we come back from break.
Well, we're not coming back.
Oh, good.
I'm sorry to say that, especially talking about the end of life here as we are, but we're not coming back, at least for this hour. Thank you all for being with us. Thank you for this hour for all of us here at KQED. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.